Welcome to the Space Coast meeting of February 27th, 2010. Would you all please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance? Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. We have quite a meeting going today. We have the elections for Space Coast Board of Directors, and we also have a very talented speaker. We have some new business members, Shanko LLC, World of Homes, Condo Care Services, Rigdon Alexander and Rigdon, BC Project Management, Consolidated Environmental Engineering, Mediation Station, and Community Association Institute, the Mid-Florida section. We'll have SCCH Treasurer's Report. Clay, would you please?
Good morning, everyone, and I'm also pleased to announce that we have a brand new association member, so new that I didn't get a chance to hand this to Roger before he made the announcements, Bermuda House, and we're pleased to have them with us. And as some of you know, this is my swan song as treasurer. But I'm pleased to say that I'm leaving that job and handing it on with SCCA in excellent financial condition. We have no debts unpaid except for the bill for the rental of this room this morning. Everything else is current. And currently we have, in a combination of our checking account and certificate of deposit, we had $35,384.15 in the bank. So we're doing quite well in terms of our financial standpoint. It's been a pleasure to serve all of you, and with that, I'll hand it back to Ron.
Thank you, Clay.
Thank you.
Today we have the election for the board members. I need two volunteers to be able to help count the ballots. A gentleman and a lady right there, lovely. Would you come to this table over here, please? We have enough proxies, and by people here, we have enough to meet our quorum for the election. And I will announce the winners, if you want to call them that, at the end of the meeting. And just to let everyone know who is also on the nomination list, after the meeting, we'll all meet the new board members along with any of the existing board members that are still here. We'll be meeting in the back room and for an orientation meeting, and we'll have room in the back for about four, maybe five guests. Thank you. I first would like to announce and thank ServPro of South and West Brevard, Mrs. Dana Reddington, for all the little goodies that you guys are eating this morning. And Dana has been kind enough. She brought in a gift certificate for $150 worth of rug and furniture cleaning. There'll be a drawing after the meeting, so anybody who has a business card or you want to write your name on it on a piece of paper, put it in the little basket that's in the back, and there'll be a drawing, and you can win a $150 gift certificate. Thank you, Dana. Just on a quick note, for those of you who responded to our amendment change that we sent out to everyone, unfortunately, we did not receive enough back to be able to do that ballot, the amendments this year. We fell about 25 short. So we'll try it again during the summer or around the early fall, and hopefully we'll have a better response. SCCA will have its 12th annual trade show, which will be held at the Crown Plaza, Melbourne, Oceanside, on March 22nd. Check the website if you're looking for more information. There's going to be really no better place to meet in a confined area, such a group of vendors. 90% of them are existing vendors that are in our directory, and probably 10% or so are new members who will be joining. It should be quite a show. We have tables available for 101 tables this year inside the rooms. So we're getting a lot bigger each year. So your participation on this would be greatly appreciated if you have the time. It's only 4 hours. It comes starts at 9, it's over at 12. Our next Space Coast meeting will be here on April 24th, and it'll be on the role of Citizens Insurance for Association. Their next President's Forum will be March 13th. I can't keep going, Steve. I'm waiting for Danielle. Okay. What show?
Trade show.
Trade show. Okay. I think it's 22nd. I have just been corrected by Beverly. I said March 22nd for the trade show. It's March 20th. My apologies. Today's program, Steve. For today's program, we have Ms. Danielle Carroll, who is the director of the Florida Office of Civil Rights. Florida's Attorney General Bill McCollum named Danielle Carroll as the Director of the Office of Civil Rights in September of 2008. Prior to that, some of you may have known her as the Ombudsman for the state of Florida, which she did a phenomenal job. She was exceptionally proactive. Prior to her appointment as the Ombudsman, Ms. Carroll worked several years as an attorney with the Department of Health, and she also spent several years in private practice. She's received her undergraduate degree from Florida International University and her JD degree from the University of Texas. She's licensed attorney for over 13 years, and she's licensed to practice in both Florida and Texas. In 2007 and 2008, Ms. Carroll was recognized by Florida's Trend magazine as one of the top government attorneys in the state of Florida. Danielle, it is my pleasure to introduce Ms. Danielle Carroll.
Thank you. It's a lot of pressure when people say you're a phenomenal speaker. Because then you can never live up to that. Well, thank you for having me here today. I really appreciate it. A lot of people may recognize me from, I've been here a couple of times before when I was the condominium ombudsman, and I always have a special place in my heart for Harry. He's always been just a wonderful person, and I just have to say this because he was one of the first people when I became the ombudsman, and people may not remember that time. There was a little turmoil involved in the changing of the ombudsman's, but Harry reached out to me and offered his hand in friendship and help in any way that he could, and I really appreciated that, and so I just want to recognize that today, because that's really always very helpful to somebody when you're new coming in the door, that somebody reaches out and says, welcome. And that's a good segue into community living, too, because you know, you want people to say welcome when you come and live in a new community. Well, you know, I wish that we didn't have issues like discrimination. That would be really wonderful. Now, I became the director of the Office of Civil Rights in September of 2008. I left from being the ombudsman to working for the Florida Attorney General's office. And I have to say that when you're dealing in civil rights, it's eye-opening. you don't realize, even if you think you know, you don't know how much discrimination actually is still taking place today. We tend to think of discrimination as being an issue that is, no pun intended, very black and white in the sense of people say, well, fair housing laws. Okay, what does that mean to most people? They're thinking it's, well, you can't discriminate against somebody of another race that's coming in. A lot of people think it's about, you know, you can't discriminate against black people who are trying to move into a community. However, civil rights and discrimination isn't just about blacks. It's race. That means white, black, Hispanic. It can be anybody. National origin. Where you come from? You come from another country. You're disabled. In a world that has become increasingly, more and more people are disabled as we age. And luckily science has progressed such that we're living longer. But a lot of people are now disabled. According to the 2000 census, U.S. census, I believe it was over 3.2 million people in Florida are disabled. So that's a lot of people in a population. I think we have like over 14 million people. That's a big percentage of people who are currently disabled. So every single person in this room has the ability to either be a person who gets discriminated against, or a person who is doing the discriminating. And it's very easy to do it because a lot of people don't know that there are even fair housing laws, what they say, what it means. And, you know, you might say, well, what do I really care too much about it? This doesn't really affect me all that much. Well, it will, because if you sell your home, you fall under fair housing laws. And if you do things in your advertisements or in deciding that you don't want to sell to a particular person for whatever reason, because of race, or you don't like, you know, people from another country, it's going to get you in trouble. As community associations, you make those decisions, because a lot of communities, and, you know, if people could raise their hand, how many people here have a screening process in their community for anybody who sells their units? Does anybody have any kind of screening process? That gets a lot of people in trouble, too. So there's a lot of things that I'm going to go through today and talk about that are going to affect you. And one of those is, as unit owners who may be selling, or also as a board that is dealing with people moving into the community, and rules and regulations that constantly get people in trouble because of the fact that, and I know this as being the ombudsman, those rules have been in place for the last 50 years. And nobody has bothered to look at them. Now, I know that doesn't go on here because you guys get educated all the time about updating your documents. So I'm sure nobody has old rules in place, but that's a big place that gets a lot of people in trouble. And it's not even just that the rules are old, but it's how they're worded. And they tend to discriminate a lot of times against, especially, people with families with children. Because children get discriminated against all the time. And you think you're being protective of children when, in fact, you're discriminating against children in how you word things. And like I said, I'm going to go into this in more detail, but just to give you an example, if you have a rule that says any children under the age of 18 must be supervised by an adult, you're violating the Fair Housing Act. You can't have rules like that because that's a very restrictive rule. And the courts, even though it's going to get judged on an individual basis, the courts have said that is way too restrictive. Even if you say, oh, we believe it's for safety reasons, you can't do it. And we'll get into that in a little more detail later. I just want to raise this for a minute because this might be something you see around the office but nobody ever pays attention to. It's a HUD poster. And on that HUD poster it says it's illegal to discriminate against any person because of race, color, religion, sex, handicap, familial status, or national origin. In the sale or rental of housing or residential lots, in advertising the sale or rental of housing, in the financing of housing, in the provision of real estate brokerage services, in the appraisal of housing. So it has all of these things, and it also has, you know, where you can call to file a complaint, because that's really important. If you believe that you've been discriminated against, you can file a complaint with Housing and Urban Development, or we have an equivalent, substantially equivalent agency here in Florida, which is the Florida Commission on Human Relations. And you can file a complaint saying, you know, I believe that I got discriminated against in this cell of the house or in the rules and regulations of my community, and the Florida Commission or HUD will send somebody out and do an investigation. And then they'll make a determination about whether or not you, it's reasonable cause to believe that a discriminatory act has occurred. And when that happens, and people at that point have an opportunity under the Fair Housing Act, which is Chapter 760, which falls under the Florida Civil Rights Act, to make a decision about what they want to do. So once they get their determination from the commissioner or HUD, they can then choose under the Florida Civil Rights Act and the Florida Fair Housing Act, which is part two of that, to decide what action they want to take. So they can choose to either go and hire a private attorney, or in that choice, they can choose to elect the Florida Attorney General's office to represent them. And so if you see my name or our office involved, you know somebody elected to have us represent them, because these are the type of issues that are important to the state of Florida, because we don't want people discriminating against anybody. So people always ask me, you know, how do I ensure that, you know, I'm not discriminating against anybody? It's very simple. Treat everybody the same. It's a simple rule. If you live by it, it usually keeps you out of trouble, unless you're doing wrong with everybody, then it will get you in trouble. But if you are doing the right thing with everybody the exact same way, then it really does keep you out of trouble. The other thing I want to emphasize today, and I'm probably going to say it repeatedly, is document what you do in your community. So when somebody says this happened, you have documentation too that shows what happened. Because when FCHR, the Commission on Human Relations, is actually going and doing their investigations, if you have paperwork to show this is what happened, it will help clarify some of the issues. And maybe it gets you out of trouble because it shows that you didn't discriminate. Every single person, we do it the exact same way. So first I want to talk about advertising. For you as unit owners who may decide to sell your homes, the thing that you have to remember is you might not want children in your house. You might want to sell it, but you might say, or even rent it, and say, you know, I don't want small children. That's illegal. You can't do it. So if your advertisement stays and you're renting, so I'm going to use a rental example, no small children or teenagers welcome, that implies that you want older kids if you say teenagers welcome. And if you are only renting to people with older kids, you're not renting to anybody who has younger children, that's a fair housing violation. And you can't have language like no small children. Anything that implies a preference, you can't do. Catholics only. You know, blacks only. You know, you can't do that because it's against the law. Now, there's some, and especially in advertisement, because normally in housing, you have to own more than 3 units for, you know, sale or rental to be affected by the fair housing laws. If you own less and you're renting out, you shouldn't discriminate, but you fall under an exemption. But you don't when it comes to advertising. So if you go and advertise something that shows a preference and somebody catches it, you're going to get in trouble for it. So the best thing to do is to, when you're advertising your unit for sale or rental, talk about the unit. You know, don't get into what type of person you want to live there or buy from you. Stick to those basic things about the unit itself. You know, it has a nice pool. It, you know, it has those things and amenities that people are going to want. And when people come to you to come and ask about this home for rent or sell, again, make sure you treat everybody the same. Because the federal government has testing programs where they'll send people in to see how you're treating people. So you might be one of those people who are luckily getting a tester because somebody complained and said, you know, I went over to this place today and I went to go and ask about this rental or this unit, and I really think they were discriminating against me. And the bad thing about discrimination is most people don't do it so blatantly. They do it with a smile. It's one of those things that happens where people are smiling at you while they're discriminating against you. And they can discriminate against you because you came in and you had a cane or a scooter. And that person says, well, I don't want to rent to that person because they're disabled, and that's going to cause me a headache. Well, you can't do that. You can't sit there and say, make those decisions about people because you don't want to be bothered with a particular person. Because, again, when that happens, you're going to get in trouble for it. So be careful in making sure you treat everybody exactly the same. And you can't say things to people like, well, you know, there's a nice community down the block that is really good with kids. They love kids down there. You're in trouble. It's a violation. You can't steer people somewhere else. And if somebody calls you and asks you, is your unit available for sale or rental, and you say no, when it really is yes, and you've done it because you don't want to rent or sell to somebody of another race, or you know some particular thing about them that falls within these protected categories that I talked about earlier, it's a violation. So there's a reoccurring theme here. It's a violation if you do these things. If you just treat everybody the same, it's probably going to get you out of trouble because you're treating everybody exactly the same. And, you know, if you have people that are, you have multiple candidates, you know, maybe you need to stick to the first come, first served, you know. If that person was the first one that applied and everything else is equal, you know, maybe just give it to the first person that came in. There's no preference of thinking about, well, I like this person better than that person, because that might get you into trouble, because sometimes we're unaware personally of the reasons why we don't like someone. Sometimes, you know, it's hard for us to accept in ourselves that we may have prejudices, and we don't think we do, but we do, because it's a constant battle to not stereotype, and that's for all of us. I don't think anybody's immune from doing that. You know, you get things and you stereotype people and things, and that may not be true, including people who may have been, say, even arrested at some point, or I won't say arrested because that's not a really good example. Say that they've had, maybe you're a community that does background checks or these kind of things. Well, sometimes people may have run in with law enforcement, not because they're doing anything, but because maybe they were married to somebody who was abusive. So maybe they're in a domestic abuse situation where the police have been constantly called out. And you learn that information that, you know, the police have been called out there like 4 or 5 times. We don't really want somebody like that in our community, when the reality was they were a victim of domestic violence. And, you know, and they've moved on in their life. And that's not a reason to stop that person from living in your community. You know, so you have to think about those things and when you're making these kind of decisions. So for those people who finally go about selling their homes and you have a particular prospective buyer or tenant, and you have to go through the screening process in your community as a board. Boards need to be very aware of making sure that you have very clear and written policies on your screening process. Because one of the things that gets boards in trouble is the fact that they don't. And, you know, and as everybody knows, sometimes you have certain, we'll call them rogue boards, that make the rules as they go along. And people have dealt with those boards before. You know, you come in the door, they've never done any of this ever before. Now all of a sudden, you have to go through a background check, a credit check. You know, they might even want a DNA swab later, you know, to really make sure you are who you are, because this is the rules in this community. And then you find out there's no such rules. There's no rules at all. And the reason that they did that was because that particular person who may fall under a protected class because of race, and I want to emphasize, discrimination happens in race against everybody. You can, you know, black, white, it doesn't matter. People get discriminated against. And so if you are a white person who gets discriminated against, you're protected under the Fair Housing Act. You know, sometimes people forget these things. It's race. It's not any particular race. So if you're discriminated against, you have protections. But when you choose to use that against somebody by saying, well, I don't want this particular person here because I don't particularly like these type of people, you know, and you're doing background checks and credit checks and your documents don't require that, you're going to get in trouble for it. So you got to remember, you got to have the same rules for everybody. So if you're wanting to do credit checks and background checks, you need that as part of your policies for that screening process. It needs to be very clear to every single person that comes into that community, this is what happens when you apply to live here. And here's our policy on it. So we're going to do a background check. We're going to do a credit check and take them through all of the steps that are in place. And for every single person that comes to that door, that's a tenant or, you know, a possible tenant or a person, that unit owner, you need to do the same thing every single time. And if you do the same thing every single time, when somebody says, I got discriminated against, you will say, well, wait a second. Here's the last 20 people that applied to live in this community, and we did a background check and credit check on every single one of those unit owners, every single one of them. And you know what? That investigator is going to look at that, and they're going to go, okay, well, and here's our rules. It said it very clearly that this is what we do. It's hard to dispute when you have written policies and you do the same every single time. What gets you in trouble is you don't have a rule, you then apply it to this person who falls under a protected class, and you haven't done it with any other unit owner ever in the history of your community. It's glaring when that happens. It just stands out. It's just like, you know, somebody put a bright neon light, an arrow, on the fact that there's some questionable practice that may have gone on here. Obviously, there could be a legitimate reason that's not related to that, so, you know, it's not always 100% clear-cut, but it's going to make it look pretty bad, and you're going to have a really hard time trying to prove that it wasn't discriminatory. So when you're formulating these policies and procedures, think of these things. Now, the two biggest areas that boards really deal with are called, you know, familial status, which is children under the age of 18. Lot of discrimination when it comes to children, families with children. And it comes in so many different ways, because a lot of communities in Florida like to call themselves 55 and older communities, even though they have done nothing to establish themselves as 55 and older communities. In Florida, you actually have to register your 55 and older community with the Florida Commission on Human Relations. That is a requirement of the law. So, which a lot of people, I found, don't bother to do. And they say we're 55 and older because a lot of people don't want to be bothered with children. So they say we're adult community. And in an advertisement where you say adult community, not a good thing. Because you're implying you don't want children. So you just really kind of stay away from those kind of words like adult community. You know, if you're really truly a 55 and older, there's things that you have to do, like register, do verifications of the unit owners to basically show that at least 80% of the community has an occupant that's 55 and older. And you need to do that every 2 years. You have to keep on recertifying and verifying that your community still falls under a 55 and older. And not only that, all of your governing documents and stuff need to say in there that you are a 55 and older community, and have policies and procedures for being a 55 and older community. Because the thing about a 55 and older community is the one area where you get to discriminate against kids. If you're actually a 55 and older, you can say no children. You can do that. You can have no children everywhere in your policies because you've established your community as one that is for adults over 55. And that is an exemption that's in the statute. It keeps you out of trouble, but you want to make sure that you continue to verify those owners as being over 55. Because what happens is some communities go through the bother of actually establishing themselves as 55 and older communities, and then they let it lapse. They didn't verify, they haven't been verifying the ages, they haven't been doing any of those things, they haven't been registering, and then all of a sudden, for whatever reason, somebody moves in that has children, or somebody moves in children into the community, and everybody's up in arms about it because they're saying, well, wait a second, we're 55 and older. How is Bob, if there's a Bob here, I'm just using Bob as an example, not that you would do it. Why is Bob moving in a 10-year-old? That 10-year-old's not allowed here. Well, you find out it's okay for Bob to move in a 10-year-old because Bob figured out you've let your 55 and older status lapse. And now that kid can live in that community because you no longer are a 55 and older community. So you really have to stay diligent in making sure that you have your policies and procedures in place, that you constantly do your verifications every 2 years and resurvey and make sure. And that's like getting, you know, people's IDs and checking and making sure that they're 55 and older and making sure that you fit within those requirements if you want to keep that exemption. But if you're not a 55 and older, you don't have a right to discriminate against families with children. You can't have different rules for different people. And that is one of the problems that has occurred in some communities with families with children. And so one of the biggest issues is rules that tend to focus in on stopping children from doing things. A friend of mine actually, called me one day because she has a little grandbaby, and she's saying, you know, my grandbaby is like 3, and she owns a condominium in North Florida, and they wouldn't allow her to have the child in a diaper in the pool. And their rules say no children and diapers are allowed in the pool. And she was just like, is this right? Can they do that? And I said, well, no. Because the reason why you would have a diaper rule is because you're worried about contamination. I mean, that's why, you know, the people in that community put this rule in place. However, there's adults who wear diapers. So you have a rule that says children under 3 can't wear diapers, and you didn't think about the fact, well, what about adults who wear diapers who are getting into the swimming pool? So you can't aim it at children. If the issue is about sanitation for your pool, then it needs to address everybody who wears a diaper. And that's something that people don't even think about. And it's not even that you're trying to discriminate. You just don't think about it because you're just thinking, oh, my gosh, the kid is in a diaper. But the reality is, if you really want to be fair in the rule and the practice of the rule, it'll apply to every single person that wears a diaper. And you still should pick the least restrictive. So maybe that's wearing some sort of garment that stops any sort of leakage because that's what you're really trying to do. So you really need to think about what are you really trying to protect against, not about the actor per se. So, you know, but when you're sitting there, and I've seen these rules a lot of times. Another rule I constantly see that people do is children cannot play in the walkway. No children in the walkway. Well, okay, I understand you may not want children playing in the walkway, but it has to apply to everybody. If you're wanting, you know, people not to loiter or to sit there because, you know, it may cause some safety risk, then no one should be able to loiter in the walkway. Nobody should be loitering in the parking lot. So the rules need to apply the same to everybody, because that's what keeps you out of trouble, applying the rules. But don't do it as a pretext that, you know, it's very clear that you're trying to get around the issue by coming up with a rule that's for everybody, but it's really aimed at children, you know, because sometimes people do that. But I just want to emphasize, this is like treating everybody the same really does keep you out of trouble. And I know I'm going to sound like a broken record, but it really is a key statement for me to make for you today. If you remember to treat everyone the same, it's probably going to be a good way to protect you from any kind of discrimination. Now, I'd also say, you know, I had brought some fair housing statutes with me so that you could actually see what the law says about these various different things. The beauty of the fair housing laws is that you have a lot of organizations that will be more than happy to help you if you have questions. You can call up HUD, and I've seen attorneys do this. I've done it where there's a question. I just had an issue that arose, and I'm not really sure what the answer is, and, you know, because it's just really not an issue that is very clear. And so I called HUD. I haven't got my answer back, but so I'm not going to tell you what the question was, because it's just going to confuse everybody, because it confused me. But the thing is, I could go to HUD and ask them, would you enforce this? If you saw this rule, would you actually find that this is discriminatory? And a lot of times HUD will give you an answer. So you can get help in drafting rules and regulations. And so one of the things I'd recommend you to do is go back through your rules and see if it has any kind of rules that say must be supervised, you know, children must be supervised, anything that looks like it discriminates against any particular group, especially, like I said, kids. Because usually in the rules, it's really about children and communities that allow children. They have it all the time. Now, when it comes to, like I said, must be supervised by an adult, children under 18, the courts are very clear that that's way too prohibitive. However, it varies depending on when you get to a lower age, because you may have a rule that says children under 6 must be supervised by an adult that's in the pool. And courts have said, you know, a child under 6 needing adult supervision, you know, that's fine. That rule is fine. So it varies depending on the situation. They're not really clear cut in what is the actual cutoff age where you could say must. But the thing that I would suggest for you to do is try to find the least restrictive way to promulgate your rules. When it comes to, you know, denying people the ability to do certain things, you really need to think about it. You really may want to get your counsel involved in helping you make sure that you're complying with the Fair Housing Act, because you just don't want to be in trouble. It can be very cost prohibitive for you to have to go to court and have to litigate cases. And boards deal with these issues on other things, and you know how expensive it gets. So, you know, if it's something that you could do to basically kind of, you know, I like to watch the Andy Griffith Show, and you know how Barney would go, nip it in the bud, Andy. You know, you really want to nip it in the bud. If you can do it early, you can really take care of a lot of problems. So, you know, familial status is just constantly popping up. People are discriminating against children. Don't do it. The other biggest issue that I see in my office is related to reasonable accommodations. You get it constantly. Boards constantly have to deal with this issue where somebody says, I need a reasonable accommodation in your rules and services because of the fact that I have a disability. And one of the biggest things I'm going to say to board members is, please don't, just because you believe it's a sham, don't operate that way. I mean, you might think this is the biggest joke in the world. This person is perfectly fine. You know, I mean, I could look at you and I could think, wow, she looks pretty healthy. You might not be healthy. I mean, you could be a person that to walk from here to that door would practically kill you to get there, even though you may look like you are healthy as an ox. So you can't really judge a book by its cover, it's so true, and you really shouldn't make those judgments. When somebody comes and asks for reasonable accommodation to your rules, for example, and then I'm going to give you an example, because this was a story I heard right when I became the director of civil rights, and this story, this case has just stuck with me because it's just so egregious. But when somebody comes and asks for reasonable accommodation, in this particular case, this young man was living in an apartment complex, and he was a quadriplegic, and he had to, you know, he lived on the second floor, so he needed an elevator. This apartment complex had two elevators, and, you know, they were having problems with the elevators. The man went and said, look, you know, the elevators are acting up. You know, I need these elevators to get up and down to my apartment. You know, are you guys going to do something about it? Well, the apartment complex did nothing. Finally, both elevators go out. Two elevators, both out. He tells them, look, I need, you know, the use of these elevators. So the management supposedly promised him that they would, like, help assist him while these were broken to get down the stairs. Well, they didn't. So this man, every single day, had to, with assistance at times from his wife and his daughter, he dragged himself down the stairs. And he had a motorized wheelchair. So he's got to take himself, his motorized wheelchair, he's crawling, and supposedly these stairwell was just disgusting. It was filthy, it was nasty, and every single day he would have to crawl and drag and to get down the stairs and get back up. And nobody would help him other than his wife and his daughter. And he was a student at the time. And so by the time he would get to class, he was just absolutely filthy and disheveled. And he said to the point that his own classmates started looking at him and basically ridiculing him. His daughter, because she had to help her dad up the stairs, got ridiculed by her friends because they've seen her trying to carry her dad up the stairs and help him up. People in the community, in the management office, had laughed at him on occasion, seeing the struggle of him trying to get up the stairs. To the point that numerous times, because it took him so long to get up, he had to urinate on himself. He had to urinate, and he would defecate on himself. And sometimes, because people had tracked things onto the stairways, it was all on him. So he did this. Now, you would think that somebody having to do this 1 or 2 weeks, it's horrible. 7 months, those elevators were not fixed. 7 months, this man had to go up and down the stairs. And the reason they didn't fix the elevator is they said it was cost prohibitive for them to fix the elevators. Well, 7 months later, he finally calls one of the local news channels in South Florida who goes and does a story. Miraculously, after that story airs and the negative publicity, elevator's up and working. The cost prohibitive elevator is up and working. 7 months this man did this, and it was cost prohibitive. That was their reason for it. Well, it better be cost prohibitive because it wasn't in this case, clearly. And the judge even pointed that out, saying, cost prohibitive, you fixed it the moment you got bad publicity. And that cost prohibitive that they couldn't fix, they got hit for $800,000 by the judge. So fix it, or, you know, get hit later. But I think that for it, especially like a community association, $800,000 is a lot of money for an elevator repair that maybe cost a couple of thousand. So, I mean, you really have to think about those things. And that's why, you know, denying people reasonable accommodations, it's not necessarily a good thing unless it's a legitimate reason to do it. Or, you know, or they have an illegitimate reason. And I know there are people out there who want pets and want to have them in a NOPEC community. And I know because people constantly have to deal with that issue, they're pretty skeptical of every single person that says, well, I need it because I'm disabled. But a lot of people do need it because they're disabled. And in, you know, and the thing is, it doesn't have to be a service animal. You know, that's become the big issue, you know. Well, it's not a service animal. It's a cute little poodle that, you know, weighs about, you know, 10 pounds. You know, what good is that doing for this person? That can't be real. That can't be a real legitimate need for this person and their disability. Well, of course it can be, because companion animals are recognized as something that people may need for their mental or physical health. And they don't have to prove to you by giving you medical records or any of those things that they're truly disabled. However, they do have to verify that this disability, whatever it is, they don't have to tell you what it is, the mental or physical disability actually affects one or more of their major life activities. So they can get verification from a doctor or somebody else. It doesn't necessarily have to be an MD. So, you know, depending on what the issue is. So you may have somebody who has a therapist who recommends that they need a companion animal for whatever their mental disability is because it helps them get through the day and actually helps them because one or more of their major life activities is, you know, disrupted. And so basically they can get a note from that therapist saying, Ms. So-and-so needs this companion animal. One or more of her major life activities is affected for her use and enjoyment of the condominium. And that's going to be good enough. So, you know, you can, again, and I've seen an attorney do this on a case where the association's counsel actually took the letter that the person gave them and sent it and emailed HUD and asked them, is this sufficient documentation to show that they are entitled to a reasonable accommodation? HUD came back and said yes, and then he advised his board that was sufficient. So if there's a question about whether that is sufficient to prove that you need a reasonable accommodation, go to your counsel or go to HUD and ask them. This is what I received. Because the price is, it's not for you to judge whether that person is disabled, whether you believe it, whether you, you know, are mad about it. People are entitled to those reasonable accommodations, including one of the biggest ones that pop up is parking issues. I mean, parking issues are always an issue. I don't know why that is, but it always is an issue in general because people always want the good spots. However, when it comes to somebody with a disability, they need that spot because, like the person who can only walk a short distance, they can't walk two blocks from their car to, you know, where you, their assigned spot is. They may come and ask you, I need a reasonable accommodation because I can't walk that distance, so I need a spot that's in front of my unit. And say there are visitor spots or a place that you clearly could utilize to let that person do it. Do that then. Now, if you are in a situation where all the parking spots are filled, no, you don't have to boot anybody out. But you might facilitate that by going to some of the neighbors, the people that have spots, and asking them if they're willing to, you know, give up their spot so this person can be there. Because that's what being a good neighbor is. That's what being a proactive board is actually doing those things, taking that extra step, trying to work it out for that person to do it. Now, the thing that I want to point out about reasonable accommodations is the fact that you don't always get what you want as a reasonable accommodation. So just because I want this accommodation, it doesn't necessarily have to be given it to me in the way that I want it. So say, and I'm going to use a court case because it was kind of interesting. It was a woman who needed an animal. She needed a service animal because she was blind. She asked for it, but she asked for it because in their community they couldn't put fences up. And she wanted a fence because of the dog. And so she wanted a fence that went to the front of her yard so that she could sit out front with the dog. The dog could be out there and they'd be up front. Well, the association said, no, we'll let you have the fence, but it's going to be on the side of your house going to the back. And so she had an issue with that because she wanted the front fence. And the court said, you can get the reasonable accommodation, but it's not necessarily going to be what you want. So that they gave you your accommodation. It was on the side. You got your fence. You're not entitled to be have a fence that goes to the front of the yard. And that's the thing, too, is that you can look at this issue and say, it provide the accommodation, but it doesn't necessarily have to be what the person is demanding, because that may be unreasonable on what you're offering. It's like somebody saying, I want a parking spot right here, and there's a parking spot right there, but they want that one. And you say, no, I'm going to give you this one. Well, that's reasonable. You gave them an accommodation for what they wanted. They're not entitled to that particular spot that they decided they like better for whatever reason. So these are things and considerations that you really need to take into account when you're making decisions about reasonable accommodation. Yes, you can ask for that note saying that they need it. And companion animals can come in many shapes and sizes of things. Companion animals can come in the form of, you know, a hamster. It can. And, you know, and people may question that. And I think the thing is I want to emphasize to boards is, remember, when you have that situation, you don't sit there and say, when somebody says, well, why does Ms. Smith have a, you know, dog? We don't have wild dogs in this community. Don't go and say, well, Ms. Smith has a disability. That's a no-no. What you should say is, we're complying with the Fair Housing Act. We have to comply with the Fair Housing Laws. And she's entitled to that animal. And some people, you know, may have an issue with that, but I think it's your role as the board members to make sure that you keep that situation under control. Because one of the worst things that can happen is that when this person asks for this accommodation, all of a sudden they're getting harassed and intimidated by the board members or anyone else in that community, because it's against the law to intimidate, coerce, or harass people who are exercising their rights under the Fair Housing Laws. So you really want to make sure that the board sends a message that this is acceptable, she's entitled to this, and you have to live with it. Because sometimes all anybody ever sees is the animal that's not supposed to be there. They don't see the fact, and they don't know the circumstances that allow them to be there. And it needs to be emphasized. And things that I know boards always say, and they always worry about is, well, if I let Miss Smith have this animal, everybody else is going to want an animal in the community. Well, everybody in the community is not entitled to an animal. So if they are, then you probably have a lot of people who are truly disabled who really do need that companion animal or service animal to get them through the day. Now, I'm willing to take some questions if you want to ask questions in general that you might have. Oh, back. Okay.
On an accommodation basis, many of the docs allow animals 20 to 25 pounds per day. And on an accommodation, does that mean somebody has to stay within that range? Or can they go into larger animals to accommodate the accommodation?
Okay. What he asked was, in the issue of a reasonable accommodation, when you have somebody who, say you have in your documents a rule that says 20 to 25 pounds is what the animal weight is, do you have to abide by that? No. In the reasonable accommodation, say somebody's blind and has a service animal, say they have a German Shepherd that's 75 pounds. They'd be entitled to have that 75-pound German Shepherd. Okay, he's asking if it's a new situation. They didn't have the animal prior. You have to accommodate it. You know, people change. I mean, you know, you were perfectly healthy yesterday. Next day, you're not. So it happens all the time. So somebody may have moved into the community, plan to not have a pet there if you don't have a no pet policy, and then tomorrow they're disabled and they need a companion animal or a service animal. At that point, they ask, and I would recommend to anybody who asks for their accommodation, do it in writing. Yeah. Do it in writing. You don't have to do it in writing. And the thing is, and I'm happy you brought that up, because the issue of the process, there is no particular way you have to do it. I can come and verbally ask you for that accommodation. I've asked for it. I don't have to put it in writing. I don't have to say I would like an accommodation because I'm disabled. You don't have to put any particular language in it. And I would say to any board members, you really need to have policies and procedures in place in dealing with reasonable accommodations. Again, that way everybody gets treated the same way. Everybody knows what the procedure is. You say, you know, and to do it quickly, because sometimes somebody asks for accommodation, months and months and months go by that you haven't given them accommodation. And it's just like with anything. Your lack of response can lead somebody to file a complaint. Not doing something can lead somebody to file a complaint. So deal with the issue. And if you don't know the answer, if you're not really sure and you have counsel, go talk to counsel about it to say, you know, here's what the issue is. Do I need to do that? That's what counsel is there for. Or, again, contact one of the agencies. Contact HUD, the Florida Commission on Human Relations. Ask them the questions. They're all available for that. So right back here.
How does reference to your comments on age condominiums that we've gone to park registered as 55 and older?
Yeah.
Would you comment or speak to the second part of that regarding 80%?
Okay.
What happens to the other 20%? How does that work?
Okay, what he's asking about is, you know, there's kind of like an 80-20 rule in 55 and older communities, that for it to be a 55 and older community, 80% of the community has to be occupied by at least one occupant has to be 55 and older, which leaves 20% of the community that you could have somebody under 55 live there. It doesn't stop you from having. So if you say somebody who's 30 years old wants to buy into your community and you have 80% of your community is over 55, you could, unless your documents prohibit it, because then you have to look at that issue. But if you don't have any language in your documents that prohibit somebody under the age of 55 living there, you know, and it may have some restrictive language, like with the approval of the board or, you know, whatever it might be, you could fill the other 20% with people that are under 55. You can do it. Do you have a follow-up to that?
If the documents state that, does this Attorney General business supersede or
number? No, I mean, if you're a 55 and older community, and what he's asking is if you have rules or whatever that don't allow people under 55 to live there, those rules are going to apply. I mean, the law, the reason is that when you are 55 and older, you've got fit the exemption, you've got your surveys done, you've done all the things that you're supposed to do to make it a 55 and older, it gives you the ability to discriminate against people who are under 55. I've seen 55 and older communities that don't allow anybody under 55 to be there. I've seen others that say no one under 30 can come in there that, you know, fit under that 20%. It's just going to be the wording of your documents. But the reality is when you're 55 and older, it doesn't preclude you from allowing people that are younger to live there if your documents don't stop it, don't prohibit it. But you've established yourself as a 55 and older community for a reason, which is to say we don't want younger people there, whatever the reason might be. You're not going to get in trouble under the Fair Housing Law, I guess is a better way to put it, if you don't allow people under 55 there. However, you can have 20% of the community that is under that age. You just always have to make sure you're 80% or over that threshold so that your exemption doesn't lapse. And if you go under, say now your community is made up of 75%, is 55 and older, and now it has lapsed, you won't be able to prohibit anybody from selling their units or renting their units to somebody who's under that age. Okay, you were nice.
Our association in their doctors are about 25, 26 years old, makes reference to establishing a screening committee.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's very vague. Are there guidelines that your organization has that a screening committee can follow so that we're not in conflict with any of the laws?
No. But what he asked is that he asked if our organization, with the Attorney General, has any kind of guidelines in regards to establishing like a screening committee and things. Well, again, the biggest guideline you can go to is treat everybody the same. But you can develop those guidelines. You can go to counsel to check to make sure that you are doing things correctly. Like I said, if you treat everybody the same, you establish a procedure that is consistently being done where every single person is being handled the same way, then I think that's going to help you in staying out of trouble because you have established guidelines on how to...
We're looking at financial records, credit records on potential buyers and lenders and personal history on criminal activity.
Right, and there's nothing that stops you from establishing any guidelines that request those things. The issue is, as long as you're requesting it from every single person that walks in the door, and you're not specifically targeting any particular group, it's okay to do background checks, it's okay to do credit checks, but you need to make sure it applies to everybody fairly.
On that illustration that you had about the elevator with that gentleman,
mm-hmm.
The fire department tells you that if there's a fire, do not use the elevator.
Right.
Right? So now, would that condominium or apartment have been in violation of saying, I can't rent you or let you buy on a second floor because we can't safely get you out there. The only place you can buy is on the first floor?
Oh, you can't force people to be on the first floor. You have an elevator. I mean, you can't steer people there because you believe that there are safety concerns. Another example of that is, and I'll just use a child in this case, you have a balcony that's kind of open and, you know, like some balconies you'd fall through, you know, if you're not adults, you'd fall through because they have big open gaps, especially in some of the older condominiums where it's not as safe. And you say, well, I'm not going to rent to a child or because they could fall out of that balcony. Well, you know what? You can't do that because safety issues are a parent's concern. It's not your concern about whether the balcony is safe or not. It's the parent's concern about whether the balcony is safe or not. So they would have to actually fix that problem. If they move there and they want to put something to keep their kids from falling out, they can do that. But you couldn't sit there and say, why have an apartment on the first floor? That wouldn't be dangerous. And you can't do that even with and steer them. If somebody wants to be on the second floor, you can't steer them to the first floor because of those type of issues. I would say no. I think you would have to, the elevator's not going to work. Well, I mean, the elevator might not work. You're just going to have to do some things to get that person down. They know they're going to have some plan in place if a fire breaks out to get themselves out of that unit. So,
what are you thinking of?
So, is there anything that happened after that if we get them out of there?
I just have one request. Anybody that has ballots, if they're holding on to them, would they please bring them over to that green table over there with the gentleman with his hand up? And at this time, is there anyone that would like to make a nomination for the board of directors from the floor?
Thank you.
Sorry, Danielle.
No problem. One of the questions, I'm going to do a question, and I'll go back. Ask, are smokers a protected class? No. Smokers are not a protected class under the Florida Fair Housing Act. Okay.
But the
I believe it's 18, but I'm sorry. He asked, what's the legal age in Florida to sign a document, a legal document? I mean, normally children under 18, you know, aren't going to be held to a contract because they're not able to sign contracts. I believe it's 18 in Florida. That's an interesting question. She asked, for children who are in the pool, can you have language that is restricted to, say, adult supervision for children who are like age 12? That's one of the gray areas, because it's really been kind of on a case-by-case basis. 12 seems to be a number that, like, children under 12, you probably could get away with having must be supervised. Again, though, I would say try to use the least restrictive, because one of the issues, and this has come up recently for me, so this is why I'm going to say this. When you restrict it to an adult, that would stop a 12-year-old or 11-year-old, say, from going to the pool with their 17-year-old brother. So you might want to think about those things where a 17-year-old may be perfectly capable of supervising, and probably is, supervising a 12-year-old or 11-year-old at the pool. So you might want to take those into consideration of, like, older children being able to be that supervision instead of restricting it just to adults. So because, you know, the purpose behind it is you're concerned about safety. But safety is not always enough. I mean, you have a concern about safety, but in a lot of pools, especially because you don't have a lifeguard, and obviously if you have a lifeguard, that can change a lot of things in regarding whether it must be supervised by an adult. Because if you have a lifeguard there, that inherently reduces the risk to people of drowning. Now, if you don't have a lifeguard, which a lot of condominiums don't, then you may be concerned about the safety issue of younger children who can't swim. But once you start getting into, you know, prohibiting an 11-year-old from going with your 17-year-old, you know, a court might rule and say that is way too restrictive of a rule. And it's just one of those areas that it's just not clear because the courts vary. There's been cases where they said, you know, 14 restrictive and 14 was too restrictive. There have been cases where 12 was fine. You just don't know. It depends on the cases and where you're at in court.
A lot of associations have rules that have to go back to the interview process, single-family apartments. And the intent of that is not to have, say, you have a 2 or 3-bedroom property, and the intent is not to have, for example, 8 bachelors running a 2-bedroom space with this one family. The whole intent of the intent. Or you can have a situation where you have a single parent, or two children, maybe another, if you could be a property, another single parent wants to move in. But now you're violating the single family, which is a very gray area, but that's
okay, what his question was in regards to occupancy standards in communities, whether or not, because you might not want to have 8 people living in a, you know, 1-bedroom apartment or something, or unit, can you do that? You can have occupancy standards for your community. Now the question becomes, you might want to look at your own local ordinances that regarding occupancy to get some guidance, because a lot of times they do have those standards there. Things that people need to take into consideration are, you may have a 2-person, and HUD has some guidelines too, so you could always go to HUD and look at theirs, where they say restricting, you know, like 2 people. It's not 100% guaranteed, you're right, it's kind of gray, that 2 people in a room is, you could say 2 people could be in 1 room. So if you have a 2-bedroom, technically you could have 4 people in that unit, 2 people sharing a room. However, one of the issues that comes up at times is like a family who has 2 kids and say they're in a 2-bedroom and they have a baby. Wife gets pregnant, has another child, and it's a baby. And as a lot of parents know, that kid is probably in your room, sleeping in the crib or whatever, in the room with you at that time. Some building ordinances, code ordinances, don't actually consider children under the age of 1 even an occupant. You know, so you might want to look at some of those things, or at least say, you know, a baby, why would you be so concerned about a newborn baby who's like maybe staying in their parents' room as violating your occupancy standard? It is a gray area. It's not very clear, but one of the things that you can use as guidance is actually looking at your local county ordinances to see what it says in regards to occupancy.
Bernie, the swimming pool is our situation again. If you're saying restricting, requiring a competency designation, that demonstrates that the child can swim or
Well, if you're going to do a competency test, you'd have to do a competency test for every single person. What he asked was, can you require a competency test to determine whether a child is competent to be able to swim or knows how to swim? The answer would be, no, I wouldn't go there. Because, like I said, unless you're going to have a competency test for every single person who uses that pool, which is what you could establish, like myself, I'm going to use myself as an example. Probably a 7-year-old who knows how to swim is better than me, and I'm a grown adult, and I don't swim. So I'm much more likely to drown in that pool, and I'm free to come and go as I please, than the 7-year-old who's been swimming since they were, you know, on little wings and, you know, been thrown in the pool as a baby. So that person may swim like a fish. I don't swim like a fish, and I'm going to drown. Even though I should be confident enough to know, why are you getting in a pool and you don't know how to swim? But people do it all the time. It makes no sense. They think, you know, whether they say you can drown in 2 feet of water, you know, maybe even 2 inches of water. I think it's something like, I think it's 2 inches. So you can drown in 2 inches of water, and I'm getting into a pool with, you know, it's filled up to 6 feet. You know, you would say that's very strange that Daniel did that, but if you're going to do a competency test, then you're going to have to do it for the whole community so that every single person is going to have to prove their use of their swimming abilities.
In a situation where you have a condo where the docks are like 25 years old, and some parts of those docks clearly conflict with the Fair Housing Act, the word,
right.
Okay? The idea then would be to get the docks changed.
Yes.
To be in compliance. Why, if the association tries to get the docks changed and never gets the appropriate number of votes in order to do so, what do you suggest we do?
Well, the question was, you have old documents that are 25, 30 years old that don't comply with the Fair Housing Act. And you're trying to get your documents changed, but people in the community have decided that they don't want to participate in this and are not going to allow you to do it, to change the documents to fix it. I think that, you know, my suggestion to you would be to call a board meeting and have your council come out and explain to them what that's going to mean to them if you get hit with a fair housing complaint. Because it's going to be costly. It's costly to litigate cases. It just is. And if you can do things to be preemptive, and I think that's when a board has to be proactive of explaining to their members why this is important and what it means to them. And sometimes people need to have it explained to them in such a way to show this is what it's going to cost you. Because sometimes people only understand this when you put it in terms of how much is it going to cost me to not do this. And they say, we'll be liable for possible violations of the Fair Housing Act if somebody decides to go and complain. It leaves us as an association vulnerable to these kinds of complaints and lawsuits. And every single unit owner in this community is going to be liable for paying that lawsuit if we should get hit. And I think that making sure people are very clear about what that means to them personally may actually get you over the hump. I think you just, you know, you educate people, because education is always important. You educate people to know what it really means to them, because I think a lot of people really don't think about how costly this all is when all it took was you to make some changes and to not discriminate against, you know, someone. So I'm going to go to this side because I've been kind of ignoring to the right, so I'm going to go this way right here first. He's asking, doesn't the Fair Housing Law automatically supersede the documents? Of course they do, but the problem is that when people are reading these documents and knowing what you can or cannot do, one of the things, if you get in trouble for discriminating against somebody, what's the piece of evidence that I'm going to use against you? Is your document. To say, your document say right here that, you know, children under 18 must be supervised. this is what you were doing. You weren't allowing children under 18 to use the pool without an adult being there. I'm going to use your documents against you. So it's better to, one, clarify what you can or cannot do, because a lot of people aren't going to know what the Fair Housing Act is. They may not even know what's in your documents, but there are some people who are going to read your documents and utilize those documents as a basis for the decisions that they make. So that's why you'd want to, in my opinion, change your documents. Yeah, thank you.
I think I put no pets, and sometimes I put non-smokers on.
Am I in violation? No, you did say, no pets is fine. Non-smokers is fine. They're not a protected class, as we... No pets is fine, too. I mean, if you're a no-pet community or you just don't want any pets, you don't have a right to a pet unless you are asking for an accommodation to the rules because of the fact that you're disabled. So if you don't want pets, somebody with a pet, you can say no pets. However, if somebody comes and says, say somebody who's blind and has a service animal, then, you would have to rent, even if you didn't want an animal. Okay, right here.
And two parallel questions regarding documenting procedures. One is the case where it's screening.
Mm-hmm.
If he puts in the documents he needs for credit check and the other, if you specify that, you also have to specify what your decision criteria.
Okay.
And let me say, the second one then was earlier you said that the person asking an accommodation doesn't need to document it. But if you have a procedure that says request must be documented or something like that,
well, yeah, I mean, now that his question was in regards to establishing a criteria for a screening committee where you say you have to do these particular certain things. And then the second part of that was whether or not you would have to, if you have a procedure that says you have to put it in writing, would that supersede the fair housing law that says you could put it in any way? I would say, it isn't clear on that, I would say no. I think that if you put procedure in place, hopefully most people would follow it. I think most people actually do put it in writing because they want documentation to show I asked for it on January 14th. It was, May. I mean, really, in most of the cases we get, people actually have the documentation to show they asked for the accommodation. Because most people, even when they don't have to do it, but they do. Because with anybody, you want documentation to prove your action. And then you want the documentation to show their inaction. So, but I think if you have procedures in place, people are going to usually follow those procedures when it comes to the accommodation issue. And so it's always good to have it there and say, we'd like it in writing, and we'll respond within so many days, and, have those kind of standards there so everybody knows what to expect. I'm sorry, you said, does Florida have a law on first right of refusal? To my knowledge, he asked whether Florida has a policy on a first right of refusal. Not to my knowledge. However, if you are utilizing that first right of refusal because, say, a person from out, an immigrant, is coming in and is deciding to move into your community and is buying a unit from somebody, and all of a sudden your board says, oh, no, we want to buy it. And that reason is discriminatory behind it, it's going to get you in trouble. I mean, the thing is that people sometimes use that first right of refusal to deny somebody to be able to sell their unit to somebody else. The board is basically going to say, we'll buy it from you instead. Oh, hold on a minute. The question that he added to this was, if he's an illegal immigrant, can you then stop it from happening? how are you going to know there's a legal, illegal immigrant? That's a tricky area, and I would request to say, you shouldn't be asking anybody whether they're here legally or not. That's an immigrant. That's going to get you in trouble, because unless you're asking for every single person that comes into that community to prove legal residency, then you have, but if you don't have those kind of policies, and you're basically somebody from another country is coming in buying in, and you're saying, I need proof that you are legally here, you're going to be in trouble.
So if we could put in a document, it was proof their citizenship, that is false.
Well, maybe not, because it depends on what your motive is behind it. Believe me, that's as much a factor. If your motive of having that rule is to exclude immigrants out.
No, the motive is that they're able to pay the maintenance fees and continue to be a viable tax.
Right. But when you're trying to verify whether somebody can pay or not, that really has nothing to do with how they got here into this country. I mean, you are verifying that somebody can pay not through that. I mean, you're not verifying I'm a legal resident and my ability to pay. You're verifying whether I have money.
I'm assuming if he's illegal, he's not paying taxes, not paying Social Security and all of that, and he's not playing by the rules, and now I'm going to let him come into my...
But my question would be, how would you know he's illegal? You can't ask him. You can't ask somebody to do that. You can't ask somebody, why would you ask somebody that question? That's going
to
get...
I'm trying to protect the people that have investments in my community, and you're saying I can't protect them.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying if your purpose behind is to find out whether somebody's illegal or not, it may cause you a lot of problems. And that's what I'm saying to you. Those kind of issues of whether somebody's here legally or not, isn't behind it, that isn't really establishing the purpose of whether you're trying to prove somebody can pay the maintenance fees or not. You know. So, I mean, I'm just saying, you have to be careful when it comes to those kind of policies. You have to have a policy that is not aimed at catching illegal immigrants or something. I'm just saying, you have to have a policy that applies to everybody the same, and if you're doing a legal residency requirements for everybody, you need to be very clear, and I would get with your attorney and make sure that you have a policy that's non-discriminatory. That would be my suggestion for you. I'm going to go back over here with the woman in white. Okay, she asked about cats. Well, a cat can be a companion animal. A hamster could be a companion animal. A miniature horse could be a companion animal. I'm sorry? Well, I mean, condominiums can make rules and regulations in regards to use. Now, a cat, it depends on the purpose. You could probably, your board could establish rules in regards to, you know, not having an animal loose on the common elements. You can't restrict people from using the common elements, but you could establish rules that say, basically, you know, you have to have the animal on a leash at all times. And that would not be unreasonable to establish those kind of rules. Okay, I'm going to go over them here. Right here. Well, because I can't give legal advice per se. What I would suggest that you do is draft some language if you're looking at an issue. And she asked about what kind of language you can use in regards to diapers in the pool. You could always draft some language and send it and ask HUD, is this appropriate language in regards to. And like I said, you want to make sure this applies to everybody the same way, or ask your legal counsel to draft some language for you. Okay, and then... Yeah, it's on, actually, HUD is, I can give it to you, it's on my poster. HUD's number for filing a complaint is 1-800-669-1000. 9777, and I'm sure they'll connect you to somebody if you just have a question, and I'm trying to see it from the, and I think on the back of the documents that I handed out, they actually have the numbers for like HUD and the different organizations, or you can go to a fair housing organization, they can give you that information. Okay, here it is.
What about a hospital or a spa where you say no one under stress, it's not super big or free. I forgot what I was, but no one under a certain age at all, and it's because
right. She asked about saunas and spas. And saunas and spas are kind of a different kind of category because the water gets really, really, really hot. And so the Department of Health standard, I believe, is that no one under 12 is the age. So you might want to look that up, but it's no one under 12. A lot of times the standards are there, either the health department or your local county ordinances will have standards when it comes to saunas and spas, but I know that the Department of Health standard, because I just had that question somebody had asked, and I checked on it, it was no one under 12 is, you know, could be in the pool, you know, unsupervised without an adult. Because there's real issues on danger when it comes to saunas and spas.
It doesn't matter whether you've got four adults, you're three or something like that, you cannot be in a hospital.
Well, I think then when you're talking about just absolutely stopping someone from using the hot tub without supervision, I think you get into that area of possible trouble. Because for a parent, the thing with housing laws, it really is the responsibility of the parent to determine what is safe or unsafe for their children. Now, you know, you could sit and say, you know, children under this age should not do it. I mean, you're not saying you must, but, you know, you might make recommendations or say, we recommend that children under this age not use the sauna. But I think if a parent wants to allow their kid to use the sauna with them, that would be the parent's decision in regards to that. However, it's inherently dangerous. And I haven't seen any language that allowed just absolutely prohibited that child from being able to use it under any and all circumstances. So, but I'll double check if you want to, you can get my card. If you want to call me, I'll double check and see what the exact language is on that because I don't want to mislead anybody and say this is definitively it. But yeah, my understanding of it was you with supervision. Okay, right here.
What about parents?
Just
to be able to see children and all their kids
having
a playtime and
have fun. You're saying that parents are swimming.
In the pool, clogging, whatever. And all the kids, say three or four of them, play at the hot tub like it's a waiting pool.
Well, you know, the thing is, while it's going to, she's asking if you have a parent who are in the pool while their children are over in the hot tub sauna or something, hot tub, treating it like a waiting pool, I think was the description. And, you know, what about that situation? Well, it's hard for me to give an answer to that because you don't really know under what circumstances. If they're under supervision and they're of age that they could use the pool, and the parent is in the pool, actually paying attention to their kid, you know. But that's one of those kind of gray areas because supervision is one of those words. Well, what does that really mean? You know. So the parent's there, the kid is there. They say, "I'm watching my kids." You know, and you know that's what's going to happen. They're going to say, "I'm watching my kid the whole time. I haven't lost sight of them yet. And so I'm watching what they're doing." You know, so I think you get into those kind of gray areas on that. But obviously you would hope that establishing rules that are just so restrictive that it's discriminatory is just, you know, that's just a negative thing. But, you know, there are people, adults, and I have to say this, there are people who are adults who use hot tubs like a waiting pool. I mean, there are adults who treat hot tubs in ways that, and we know it exists because you've seen it, that are doing the exact same things that you're trying to keep kids from doing. Adults are doing the exact same thing. So the easiest thing, once again, to do is treat everybody the same way. And if you know, if there's certain behaviors that are inherently dangerous for everybody to be doing, then you have rules that establish that for all parties. And you go from there. Because like I said, I know a few people who have used hot tubs inappropriately. Okay.
Can an association keep soliciting votes after a meeting has been adjourned? Can an association keep soliciting votes after a meeting has been adjourned?
Well, I don't understand what you mean by soliciting votes. He asked, can an association continue to solicit votes after a meeting is adjourned?
They don't have sufficient numbers to pass the item, so they just, as the meeting is adjourned, they just keep going. So if they have sufficient numbers, then the next meeting they say they have sufficient numbers.
Well, since I am no longer the condominium ombudsman, I'm going to stay away from that topic, but I would suggest to you, because I know Gary Polyakoff is coming in June, to ask him that question, but you could also call the Ombudsman's Office or DDPR and ask them that question. Sorry.
You mentioned that the letter of respect for a handicapped or service animal, can it just be general? Do you have to give any kind of medical information? Because it's been read out at our unit owner meeting, all the medical information.
Okay, she asked is, when it comes to the request for an accommodation, do you have to give out your medical information? Absolutely not. Medical information is protected. You don't have a right to see what somebody's medical information is to prove that they're disabled. You have no rights at all to see that. You have no rights to pass it out, and if you do that, it's going to cause you trouble. You don't have a right to do that. So the answer is no.
There's an investigation from the Commission on Human Relations on a particular incident, and other incidents come to light, you know, it becomes a pattern. What are some of the penalties that a condominium association could face if they announce a violation?
What she asked is that during the state, there appears to be some sort of discriminatory practice, and then the Florida Commission comes out, on Human Relations comes out and does an investigation, and they find out that there's a pattern or practice of this kind of discrimination that's going on repeatedly. Well, and she asked, what kind of penalties are you looking at? Well, I mean, it's like in anything. You could end up, because it's intentional and willful conduct on the part of an association, so say you get sued, you could be open to punitive damages because of the fact that you have intentionally done this. You knew about it, or say it on a reasonable accommodation. You knew that the person was disabled, you knew that they needed this accommodation, and you just refused it. And all the evidence points to you, time and time again, anytime anybody ever asked for an accommodation, even though you know that they really truly are disabled, that you refuse. Well, that's going to be used against you in a court of law. I mean, it's going to be used to say this conduct by this particular board is egregious, it's intentional, it's willful on their part, and it's so egregious and willful that we want punitive damages besides getting compensatory damages for this particular client. We want punitive damages because their conduct is just outrageous. And when you have that, you can get hit with a large amount of punitive damages because it's shown that you really intentionally did this. So you got to be really careful. I mean, monetary loss is the biggest thing that anybody's trying to avoid, is losing money. So that's always a factor of any kind of discrimination. People are entitled to get their damages, what they've, you know, what it's cost them. They can get emotional distress. They can get, you know, they can get all those things. And if it's willful on your part, you can get hit with punitive damages that will even skyrocket that amount to another whole other level. In the case of the elevator example, he was awarded $420,000, but he got another $420,000 in punitive damages. So that tells you right there that you just went from 420 to 840, and that didn't include attorney costs and fees right there, because it was so willful and intentional, 7 months that they didn't do this, that the court said it deserves, let me just double that, you know, and hit you with another $420,000.
Any
policy that you mentioned, if they have been published and passed out to all of the district owners concerning either what the RECO agreement says or any of the other regulations that are designed to jump on the board and approve this board and published and put on our website, if that's considered an offer, must they be filed in order to be considered?
Oh, are you talking just about rules and regulations? Well, you know, your rules and regulations, what she asked is whether or not your rules and regulations need to be filed. And this is kind of getting into kind of embezzlement land for me. But so I'm trying to stay away from those type of issues where it's really kind of embezzlement related, because since I'm now in the AG's office, I really can't answer those type of questions for you. Well, establishing rules and regulations are very different than how you, where you put those and where you file them at. And so I just have to, because I'm now with the Attorney General's office and no longer the ombudsman, it's hard for me to answer those questions for you that are not related to the Fair Housing Law itself. That would be something that you would need, and I'm sure somebody in here could answer that question for you. I'm sorry, I just can't, venture into those other areas, because then I'm giving you advice on something like that.
I'm wondering,
right. Well, yeah, you should establish policy and procedures. Well, her question is whether they need to be filed in the county courthouse or just establish policies and procedures that you have on file in your office, or you have to do some kind of formal so that they're on the records in the county courthouse. Because it's not in the area that I deal with, and so I really have to kind of stay away from those topics that are not my area, which is civil rights. It's just because as Florida Attorney General, we can't give advice to individual citizens. We don't have the right to do that. So I have to be very careful when it comes to, especially in going outside of an area that is not what I'm talking about. So I apologize. It would be very simple to give you the answer. I'm sorry.
Miniature horse. What if it is an exotic animal? Let's say it is a miniature horse, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It's more held to accommodations. Let's go to another point of that. Let's say the limited living individual has a animal care animal, but is incapable of that 80-pound dog. Now it's causing damage to the common area elements. Now where's the court stand?
Okay, his question is about, say somebody has some sort of exotic animal that is causing damage to the common elements. What is the responsibility? The person who has this exotic animal, say like a miniature horse, and it causes damages to your common elements, has to fix them.
But can a board, would the board be held to that miniature horse on the property?
It's going to depend on, but there have been cases where people have tried to get these sort of exotic animal. Would that be, well, the thing is, when you're talking about something like a tiger, where you can show, one of the issues is that you have to show, I'm not going to use an issue as a tiger, because that's a very dangerous animal, but say, like, there's questions about Rottweilers, Rottweilers are an animal that people have, and somebody may have a Rottweiler as their service companion animal, and the 3DD says, wait a second, I'm concerned, it's a Rottweiler. Well, if you can't show that that animal has caused any kind of safety issues or that you're at risk, because there have been people who have Rottweilers are sweet as can be, they're not doing anything, they're not harming anybody. If you don't have any kind of incidents where this animal has attacked people or done some sort of dangerous acts, that Rottweiler is going to be able to be that service animal. I mean, is the court's going to say it's fine to have the Rottweiler, is what I believe. Now, if that Rottweiler is biting people and doing things that are inherently dangerous in a community, you as a board have a right to deal with that issue. And if somebody has an animal, even if it's, you know, whether it's a cat, a dog, or whatever it might be, it's destroying the common elements of a community, they have to fix those things that that animal has damaged. I mean, the law says they have to pay for the damage. So you have a right as a board to say your animal has destroyed this property. Just as you would with any other person who destroys property in your community. You know, for whatever the reason is. Say somebody likes to go out and play, you know, test their golf swing every single day and makes divots in the grass in the common area. You would have them go and get that fixed because they're destroying your common element area. So it would be the exact same thing if a dog is going and, you know, for no better example than to say urinating in the same spot every single day and causing the grass to be discolored. You have a right to have them repair that damage to your grass. So,
you know, okay, from what I've heard, it sounds like we can't do anything, you know, without somebody saying we're discriminating. We can't say adults only, no children allowed, handicapped units around the first floor. You know, we can't have our rules. And it's very
Okay, what she said is that you can't do anything anymore. I mean, that's basically what it was. You can't do anything. There's rules against. But you know what? Communities are made up of rules. Unit owners complain about the same thing. What is the thing that unit owners complain about with boards? Oh, there's too many rules and regulations. I can't do anything. I can't even enjoy my own house because of the rules in the community. We're a country of laws and rules. You don't get to do everything that you want to do. However, it's not stopping anybody from doing things. What it's saying is you have to treat everybody the same when you're making these decisions, and you can't discriminate against anybody. Discrimination is the thing that is being prohibited. It's not you just making up rules and regulations. It's making rules and regulations that are discriminatory against one particular person. And no, you're not entitled to do that under the law. And we shouldn't want to do that under the law. Because discrimination is a bad thing. So when you say, well, I can't do this, well, no. You can't say to children, no, you can't, you know, be here unless you're a 55 and older community. These are laws that we should be happy exist and are on the books because you want to be able to live and enjoy being in the community that you live in. And people have children. People have age. People have disabilities. People need those accommodations. And the law says you have to accommodate them. And if you're not discriminating against somebody, you really aren't going to run into a lot of problems. You're just not. The problem occurs is when people decide that they don't like this particular group of people, or they don't believe and, you know, and want to accept the fact that somebody could be, that is disabled, they don't really believe they are disabled. That you've taken your own personal judgment into play. And that's when people run into problems. But if you treat everybody the same, it keeps you out of trouble. I really do believe that. And I think the laws are there for a reason because it says you can't discriminate. I mean, there's numbers. I mean, I think it was something like 2 out of every 5 minority gets discriminated in housing. That's a lot of people who are getting discriminated against. And there are a lot of people, I thought that in Brevard County, I thought the population of disabled people, I think they did some kind of, they pulled data between like 2005 and 2007, 17% of the population of Brevard County is disabled. 17%. That's a big amount of people who are needing those kind of accommodations that affect one or more of their major life activities. So I go, when you have those things, you have to have protection in place to ensure that people have a place to live. And Florida is one of those places where it is hard to get affordable housing. I mean, it's an affordable housing crisis. So when you have a crisis like that, and people are all vying for housing, it really opens the door to people to discriminate for whatever varying reasons there might be, because you may have 20 people who are all coming in, and you may just say, well, you know, I prefer to have somebody like me in the community instead of somebody who looks different. And it's not that, you know, that little action is discriminatory. Instead of saying, first come, first serve, whoever fits the criteria for the living in this community is who gets it, it keeps you out of trouble. Documenting everything that you do or why you're giving somebody a violation notice, all of those things of documentation are so important because it helps keep you out of trouble. Because instead of trying to remember 2 years ago why you did something, because a person who has a discrimination complaint has 2 years after that discrimination occurred to file a lawsuit, instead of trying to remember what happened 2 years ago, it's easier to go and look at your records and show this is what happened 2 years ago. So when I gave them that violation notice, this is why, this is how I did it, and every single other person that does that exact same violation in this community has gotten the exact same treatment. We don't do it any differently. So here's 20 people I've done the exact same thing to. And believe me, when it comes to court, if you've treated this one person differently, that lawyer is going to come in and point out how 20 other people violated the exact same rules that you hit this person on for, you know, 20 times, and you never once hit these other 19 people for that same violation. So that's why it's important to document what you do, and it's also important to, you know, make sure that you're treating everybody the same, because you don't want somebody to just get you in that out. I mean, it's just so easy to get you if you are treating people differently. And it's there to be seen. Sure. What she asked about is a community, you know, say a board retaliates or intimidates someone because of the fact that they've exercised their right. So say, I'm going to use an example, say someone files a discrimination complaint against your community, against the board members, names every single board member in the community as a person who has done this thing, and they go to the Commission on Human Relations and file a complaint against you. Now you're mad because you're like, this person filed a complaint, I can't believe it, and a community starts doing things to this particular person. So say you call a board meeting and you go and rail against this person who filed this complaint. And you say, so-and-so is responsible for filing this complaint against us. It's costing you, unit owners, thousands of dollars in litigation fees because they went and filed the complaint saying we discriminated against them. And now the community's mad, and the board's like telling people, don't even talk to these people because they're bad. They're just trying to hurt this community. Well, the law says you're going to get hit again because you just took an action of intimidation or threats or coercion, or say you keep on threatening them with fines for different things because of the fact that you say they're non-compliant after they filed this discrimination complaint. You can get in big trouble because the law says you can't intimidate, coerce, or threaten people for exercising their rights, because under the law, they have a right to file that complaint. They have a right to say, I've been discriminated against. And when you do things in retaliation because of the fact that they exercise their right that they're entitled to under the law, you can then get another charge against you for retaliation. So, you know what? I always say to people, applaud somebody standing up for their rights. That's fine. I mean, that's what this country is about. You have a right to stand up for yourself. That doesn't mean you did anything wrong. But they have a right to do it, and you have a right because you've documented everything. You have treated everybody the same. You're going to come and show your evidence to say, we didn't do anything wrong. We treat everybody the same here, and that's going to be fine. So that's something you really should be concerned about, because like I said, a lot of people do certain things that are in retaliation for people actually just exercising those rights. Okay, is there another question?
I'm just thinking about obligations to the city clients to prepare out in the maybe over property from the early 80s or in the 80s to come in. Say you've got a common road that dissects your clubhouse, and there's always been a curb there. Now you get a wheelchair-bound person that says, I would like to have that curb cut so I can be dropped off in the car and can be wheeled up the ramp instead of lifted up on the ramp. And the city, of course, with financial status and lack of money today, is going to resist anything that's going to cause it, right? Responsibility is that on that curb.
Okay, what he asked was a reasonable modification question, which is there's a driveway that has curves. The person has a wheelchair, wants to have an access ramp or something to get onto the ground. Well, that's an interesting question because sometimes, you know, for any kind of reasonable modification or even reasonable accommodation, it cannot cause an undue hardship to a community. So, you know, and what he was also saying is that, you know, the ADA laws don't necessarily apply to residential condominiums and communities unless they're newer built condominiums, which would apply to, they have to be ADA compliant. But older communities are not necessarily ADA compliant. It's like my house. No wheelchair could get through the doors of my house because they're so narrow. However, if somebody wanted to build a ramp, you could accommodate that and say, yes, you can build it. But depending on the cost or how cost prohibitive it is, they could pay for that modification for themselves. You know, they would pay for it, put the ramp there so that they could have access. So that's one of those issues of, depending on what it is, an associate may pay for it, but if it's a really expensive modification, the owner will take the responsibility of paying for it themselves and can then, you know, be accommodated for it, but they'll actually pay the check to get it fixed for them. You know, so if somebody asks to do that and it's, you know, would be beneficial because it is like an older community, you could say yes, you know, you can make that modification. But like I said, in a lot of those situations, the people themselves actually pay for that modification. You know, like a home, they want to widen it and do those things, the door frames. Harry, you asked a question, but I couldn't really read. I'm sorry, I couldn't read it. What was your question?
I can't read my own handwriting. Your question is to say the checklist is pretty convincing. Part of your checklist has to do with the mental capability of the person. Say the person couldn't find the bottom of the unit, there's really a guess for the question. I'm right, but I'm stuck with you. I'm just saying, why don't you? I mean, there's a lot of ways to start a discrimination.
Okay, so the buyer is the person, I mean, the seller is the discriminator in your scenario?
The buyer, they discriminated against our identity because they're telling him, no, he can't buy because his financial situation doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I guess the question is that if a person is claiming discrimination because of the fact that they were turned down by the association due to their finances weren't sufficient to pay the maintenance fees, I guess, is that what you're saying? Well, that's going to be the question. But that's a normal screening process issue. I mean, you screen people to determine whether or not they can, you know, have the ability to pay the maintenance fees and do those things. If that is part of your normal procedure for every single person that lives in that community, it's not going to be a problem. People may claim discrimination and it's not. I mean, that's a reality that happens. A lot of people claim discrimination and it really did happen to them. But again, that's why I keep emphasizing, if the rules are the same for every single person that comes into that community and you're holding everybody to the exact same standards, it really does help keep you out of trouble and you document what you've done to show that each and every person went through the exact same criteria and structure and have very clear rules on it. It will keep you out of trouble, hopefully, and because hopefully you're doing everything right to begin with. It doesn't protect you if you're doing everything wrong to begin with. But if you're doing everything right, then it really is going to go a long way in showing that there's no discriminatory intent behind your actions. So I can't emphasize that enough. I really appreciate having the opportunity to be here, and hopefully I can come and visit another time. Thank you.
Thank you, Danielle. Thank you, Danielle. We have the results of our elections. They are as follows. Ron Aldridge, Bill Campbell, Doris Hess, Roger Kesselbeck, George Leonard, Gary Kitchens-Ritterstein, and Richard White. Gentlemen, thank you. Now, there'll be an organizational meeting after this in the boardroom. All new board members and any existing board members that are still here, that's where we're going to be heading after the meeting. I would like to personally thank all the volunteers that have served on the board for a job well done. Their dedication to SCCA, they have done a fantastic job for all of us. Their hard work is greatly appreciated, and I would like to take a moment to acknowledge four board members who will no longer be on the board: Mr. Clay Witt, Ms. Jackie Grant, Beverly Gouthier, and Ms. Kay Henningen. To all of you, thank you. For all your help, you have made my first year and a very smooth transition for a new president. Again, thank you. How about a hand for all of them? If anybody would like to come to the organizational meeting, we have room in the back for about four or five people maximum, because we're expecting more regular board members. Thank you all for coming, and hope to see you all at the trade show on March 20th. Now, the people with business cards did not put them in the little basket. I guess nobody wants a $150 gift certificate. Do we have any people that want to go in for the drawing? Thank you.